this, and without any further ado, I am most pleased and most happy to introduce our very special guest speaker tonight, Mr. Terrence McKenna.
Pleasure to be here. It's wonderful to see so many familiar faces and so many faces, period. I've never been to Port Hueneme before. Probably some of you feel the same way. But I've been doing a lot of traveling recently. I was in New York last weekend at the Open Center, and in Prague 2 weeks before that. So this is the end of a long season of traveling. I'm not home yet, but at least I'm in my own time zone. I want to especially thank Andy Voth and the Carnegie Museum of Art in Oxnard for inviting me to participate. It represents a real commitment to free speech and First Amendment rights, I think, for an art museum. Art museums have been taking some knocks recently, and so I think they doubly should be commended for their courage. And I want to explain, as Andy mentioned, this is a benefit for Botanical Dimensions, which explains the double price over the ticket. All of this money will go to the preservation of medicinal plants with a history of shamanic usage. That is the special focus of our botanical garden in Hawaii. And before I start the formal lecture, I'd like to just say a little bit about that. As you know, the rainforests of the world are being cleared at a very frightening rate. And perhaps voices are beginning to be heard to halt this destruction of the natural environment. But whether it's halted or not, the destruction of the knowledge of native peoples concerning the uses of the plants in the rainforest, this is disappearing without doubt in the next 30 years because these people are moving into cities, taking jobs in the ordinary market economy, and thousands of years of accumulated folk medical knowledge is being lost. So the real world political work that Kat and I do is associated with Botanical Dimensions. We conceived it together many, many years ago, and then about 6 years ago, Kat took it over, put it on its official feet, made it a non-profit foundation, and has run it day to day since then, with tremendous energy and efficiency. So I'd like to acknowledge Kat McKenna here. My better half. In fact, my only good half. Yes. And then I wanted to underscore what Andy said, a very special event 2 weeks from now at the Carnegie Museum. Roy Tuckman, Roy of Hollywood, bon vivant, countercultural figure, informational ferret of our time, will be recast as an experimental composer of great energy and imagination. And I hope you'll all turn out for Roy. He's been a wonderful force in my life and I think in the cultural life of Southern California. Both Roy and Diane have done a wonderful job in raising the quality of public dialogue in Southern California, which I think is a precondition for any kind of clear thinking about our future or our political situation. So here's to Roy and Diane. Okay. Well, the theme that unites these lectures is creativity and the techniques by which the artist can refine his or her vision, expand the vision, communicate the vision. And before I get into that issue, I thought I would talk just a little bit about my notion of creativity per se. What is it in and of itself? And when I think like that, of course, I cast my mind back to nature. Nature is the great visible engine of creativity against which all other creative efforts are measured. And creativity in nature has a curious distribution. It's something which accumulates through time. If we stand back and look at the universe, we see that at its earliest moments, it was very simple. It was a plenum. It was without characters or characteristics. It was what in Hindu mythology is called the Turiya, which is described as attributeless. And naturally, if something is without attribution, you can't say much about it. It takes a while for it to undergo a declension into more creative realms. And these creative realms are distinguished as domains of difference. The precondition for creativity is, I think, disequilibrium, what mathematicians now call chaos. And through the life of the universe, as temperatures have fallen, more and more complex compound structures have arisen. And though there's been many slipping back in this process, over very large spans of time, we can say that creativity is conserved, that the universe becomes more creative, and out of that state of creative fecundity, more creativity is manifest. So that from that point of view, the universe is almost what we would have to call an art-making machine, an engine for the production of ever more novel forms of connectedness, ever more exotic juxtapositions of disparate elements. And out of this, I believe, arises implicitly a set of principles that we can then apply to the human artist in the human world. Nature's creativity is obviously the wellspring of human creativity. We emerge out of nature almost, and this idea I think was fairly present close to the surface of the medieval mind, we emerge out of nature almost as its finest work of art. The medieval mind spoke of the productions of nature. This is a phrase you hear as late as the 18th century, the productions of nature. And human creativity emerges out of that, whether you have a model of the Aristotelian great ladder of being or a more modern evolutionary view where we actually consolidate emergent properties and somehow bring them to a focus of self-reflection. Now, I'm sure that we couldn't carry out a discussion of this sort without observing that the prototypic figure for the artist, as well as for the scientist, is the shaman. The shaman is the figure at the beginning of human history that unites the doctor, the scientist, and the artist into a single notion of caregiving and creativity. And I think that, you know, to whatever degree art over the past several centuries has wandered in the desert, it is because this shamanic function has been either suppressed or forgotten, and we've different images of the artist have been held up at different times. The artist as artisan, the artist as handmaiden of a ruling class or family, the artist as designer for the production of integrated objects into a civilization. This notion of the artist as mystical journeyer, as one who goes into a world unseen by others and then returns to tell them of it, was pretty much lost in the post-medieval and Renaissance conception of art up until the late 19th century or early 20th century, where, beginning with the Romantics, there is a new permission to explore the irrational. This really is the bridge back to the archaic shamanic function of the artist, permission to explore the irrational. The Romantics did it with their elevation of titanic emotion, romantic love specifically. The symbolists in the mid-19th century did it by a re-emphasis on the emotional content of the image and a rejection of the previous rationalism. And that emphasis on the image and on the emotions set the stage then for what I take to be the truly shamanic movements in art, which begin really with Alfred Jarry in the late 1880s and early 1890s. Jarry, you may remember, was the founder of something called the École du Pataphysique, the Pataphysical College. Jarry announced pataphysics is the science. The problem was nobody could understand what it meant or what it stood for, including Jarry. Jarry was tight with Lontremont, who you may recall said, "I am fascinated with that kind of beauty that arises when a sewing machine meets a bicycle on an operating table." See, this was a true effort to bend the boundaries of art, to create new permission really for the unthinkable. And this, again, reinforces the shamanic function. What do we mean when we say the unthinkable? We mean the envelope of that which can be conceived. And for at least 200 years, the ostensible mission of the artist has been to test the conceptual and imagistic envelope of what the society is willing to tolerate. And this has taken many forms. The deconstruction of imagery that we get with abstract expressionism, going back into impressionism and the pointillists, or the permission for the irrational imagery of the unconscious, surrealism, and German expressionism make use of this permission, always the idea being to somehow destroy the idols of the tribe, dissolve the conceptual boundary of ordinary expectation. Well, in order to do this, it seems to me there is a precondition for the creation of art, which I call understanding. And I don't mean this in an intellectual sense. I mean it in the sense that Alfred North Whitehead intended when he defined understanding as the apperception of pattern as such. There's nothing more to it than that. You see, if we were to look at this room and we were to squint our eyes, and I'm doing this right now, and I see that the room divides itself into people dressed in red and people dressed in blue. This is a pattern, and it tells me something about what I'm looking at. Now I shift my depth of field. Now I'm looking at where men are sitting and where women are sitting. This is a different pattern, and it tells me more about what I am looking at. The number of these patterns, theoretically present in any construction, is infinite. That says to me, then, that the depth of understanding cannot be known. It cannot be known. Everything is immanent. William Blake makes this point, you know, that you can see infinity in a grain of sand. So understanding, then, is the precondition for creativity. And this understanding is not so much intellectual as it is visual. Visual. And in thinking about this, I realized what an influence upon my own ideas in this area Aldous Huxley was. Not the Huxley that we might ordinarily associate with my concerns, the Huxley of the doors of perception and heaven and hell, but the Huxley of a very modest book that he wrote in the early 50s called The Art of Seeing. The Art of Seeing. And in that book, he makes the point that a good art education begins with a good drawing hand. That to be able to coordinate the hand and eye and to see into nature, to see into the patterns present as such, is the precondition for a kind of approach to the absolute. Now, out of this process of seeing, which I'm calling understanding, the creative process ushers in novelty. And many of you have heard me speak of novelty in another context, in the context of nature as a novelty-producing engine of some sort, and ourselves almost as the handiwork of nature. But this same handiwork of nature, which we represent, we also internalize and re-express through the novelty of the human world. Well, now, if we take seriously the shamanic model as a basis for authentic art, then certainly in the modern context, what we see missing from the repertoire of the artist are shamanic techniques. And it's for the discussion of these shamanic techniques, I believe, that I was brought here this evening. So I want you to cast your mind back to a great seminal moment, germinal moment in the history of human thought, which was about 25,000 years ago, the great glaciers that had covered most of the Eurasian landmass began to melt, and human populations that had been islanded from each other for about 15 millennia began to recontact each other and reconnect. And out of this comes what is called the Magdalenian Revolution from 18,000 to 22,000 years ago. And what it is nothing less than a tremendous explosion of creativity and aesthetic self-expression on the part of the human species. We find for the first time, bone and antler technology takes its place along with stone technology. Musical instruments appear over a wide area. And cave paintings, some paintings in areas and recesses so remote from the surface of the ground that it takes several hours to reach them, are painted and set up in dramatic tableaus specifically designed to bring together sound, light, and dance in hierophanies, extravaganzas of aesthetic output that invoke a kind of transcendent other that human beings for the first time are trying to come to grips with and make some kind of cultural statement about. And this pulling into matter of the ideas of human beings, first, you know, in the forms of beadwork and chipped stone and carved bone, within 20,000 years ushers into the kinds of high civilizations that we see around us and points us toward the kind of extraplanetary mega-civilization that we can feel operating on our own present like a kind of great attractor. Now, this whole intellectual adventure in exteriorization of ideas is entirely an aesthetic adventure. Until very recently, utility is only a secondary consideration. The real notion is a kind of seizure by the tremendum, by the other, which then forces us to take up matter, clay, bone, flint, and put it through a mental process where we then excrete it as objects that have lodged within them ideas. This seems to be the special, unique, transcendental function of the human animal, is the production and condensation of ideas. And what made it possible for the human animal is language. If you're seeking the thumbprint of the transcendental on the myriad phenomena that compose life on this planet, to my mind, the place to look is human language. Human language represents an ontological break of major magnitude with anything else going on this planet. I mean, yes, bees dance and dolphins squeak and chimpanzees do what they do, but it's a hell of a step from there to Wallace Stevens, let alone William Shakespeare. Language is the unique province of human beings, and language is the unique tool of the artist. The artist is the person of language. And I've, you know, given a lot of thought to this because the work that I've done with psilocybin mushrooms and the observations of psychedelic plant use in the Amazon centered around ayahuasca lead me to the conclusion that it is the synergy and catalysis of language that lies behind not only the emergence of human consciousness out of animal organization, but then its ability to set a course for a transcendental dimension and pursue that course against all the vicissitudes of biology and history over 10 or 15,000 years. Language has made us more than a group of pack-hunting monkeys. It's made us a group of pack-hunting monkeys with a dream. And the fallout from that dream has given us our glory and our shame, our weaponry, our technology, our art, our hopes, our fears. All of this arises out of our own ability to articulate and to communicate with each other. And I use this in the broadest sense. I mean, for me, the glory of the human animal is cognitive activity, song, dance, sculpture, poetry, all of these cognitive activities. When we participate in them, we cross out of the domain of animal organization and into the domain of a genuine relationship to the transcendent. As you know, shamans in all times and places gain their power through relationships with helping spirits, which they sometimes call ancestors, sometimes call nature spirits. But somehow the acquisition of a relationship to a disincarnate intelligence is the precondition for authentic shamanism. Now, nowhere in our world do we have an institution like that that we do not consider pathological, except in the now very thinly spread tradition of the muse, that artists, alone among human beings, are given permission to talk in terms of my inspiration, or a voice which told me to do this, or a vision that must be realized. The thin line, the thin thread of shamanic descent into our profane world leads through the office of the artist. And so if society is to somehow take hold of itself at this penultimate moment, as we literally waver on the brink of planetary extinction, then the artist, like Ariadne following her thread out of the labyrinth, is going to have to follow this shamanic thread back through time. And you know, one of the most disempowering things that has been done to us by the male dominant culture is to brush out our footprints into the past. We don't have a clue as to how we got here. Most people can't think further back than the first Nixon administration. Let alone, you know, the arrival of the Vikings, the fall of Çatalhöyük, the melting of the glaciers, so forth and so on. We have been disempowered by a rational tendency to deny our irrational roots, which are a kind of embarrassment to science, because science is the special province of the ego. And magic and art are the special province of something else. I could name it, but I won't. It prefers to be unnamed, I think. So how seriously, then, are we to take this, I'll call it an obligation, to follow the shamanic thread back into time?